Thanks, everybody. My name is Gina, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Laurie. Yeah, it was tough. When I first started at the intergroup office, there was a lot of transition going on, and our office manager at the time, Brenda, had been there for like 19 years, and she went to the main office, AA World Services in New York, and she had already gone when I was hired on, and Lori was indispensable. I mean, I could not have done, I might not still be there if it weren't for Lori, so thank you. And Lori, I'm sorry for your loss this year. Thank you all for letting me be here. What an honor to speak at any occasion in Alcoholics Anonymous, but who would have known, you know, that this would be the last time that this conference would be held at this location, you know, and what a blessing that is for Bill and I to be able to do that. My sobriety date is December 2nd, 1999. And my home group is the Downtown Thursday Night Group in Memphis, Tennessee. We meet, there's a home group member. We meet downtown on Thursday nights. We meet at St. Mary's Catholic Church, and oddly enough, that's where my husband's mother and dad were married years and years ago. So I love all of these ways that God just says, you are where you're supposed to be, Gina. You know, he makes that plain. And here's some of what that looks like for me. I was born in Lone Oak, Arkansas. It's a little farm town between Little Rock and Memphis. And I'm the baby of four children. I have two older sisters and an older brother. My father was a carpenter, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And my upbringing was, especially up until I was about 11 years old, normal in every respect, you know, just normal. My mom and dad were crazy about each other, you know, and they were these beautiful people. In our little town, I grew up within five blocks of both sets of my grandparents. So that was really, you know, those roots, my aunts and uncles and cousins. On my father's side of the family, we had the deacons and the song leaders and the church elders. And on my mom's side of the family, we had the convicts and the drug addicts. So it made for a rich and varied upbringing. But I tell you what that did for me is, it's not that it normalized drinking and other things as much as it did, it allowed me to see, it allowed me to not demonize those things, you know, which I think really has helped me in being a sober woman, not look at people and see them for the problems that they're bringing into the rooms early in sobriety, but to see them for the human beings that we all are. When I was, like I said, grew up in this little town, and everything was normal until I was about 11 or 12 years old, and there was a blow-up fight in my house one night, and glass breaking, and kids go flying out of the bed, and mom and dad they're fighting, and then the next thing you know, they're divorcing. I went to live with my mom, my older sister and I did, and my middle siblings went to live with my dad, and that lasted about a year and a half, and then they remarried each other. And they're still together. Now, I tried that later in my life later on. It didn't work out so well. So they remarried one another, but one thing they did is they did move to another town, and I think that helped them. You know, geographical cures get a bad rap, don't they? But I think sometimes, you know, to move away from that and to get a fresh start, you know, as long as you're doing some other things to take care of yourself, that's a good thing. And it was for our family. We went to this new town, and I was a new kid, scared, so the first time I ever did anything that was mind altering was probably when I was about 14, and I smoked a little weed, you know, and the first time I did it, it was that thing of always I felt like I was having a different experience than everybody else. You know, we were talking about AA slogans a few minutes ago, and I love that line in the Big Book where it says, outward appearances are not inward reality at all. You know, and I hear in AA, you know, I compare my insides to your outsides. And so that's what I did. And as an adolescent, you know, I just thought everybody was super cool but me, you know. And we moved to this bigger town, and there were a lot of kids that seemed super cool, and I didn't. But so the first time I smoked weed, I didn't know what to expect, and I don't think I felt anything that I was supposed to feel, but I pretended like I did, because it was real important to me that no one guessed that I was not part of, you know. And that was enough for me. The first time I ever drank anything of substance, I had not very few consequences, and I was like 14 years old, 15 years old, but I didn't drink again until I was 16, and we had transferred to another school, and I'd gone out on a double date with some new kids, and so they went to the liquor store and got someone by for us. And my parents, we didn't have alcohol in the house really growing up. So I didn't know what to drink. I mean, my mother, I knew that she would drink bourbon and Coke when there would be like a little house party, or they would go to the VFW or something, and she would get a little bourbon and Coke, and she would put it down, and she would go in the kitchen and get the chips and dip, and she would go and mingle, and it would get watery, and she would just forget about it. I've never had that experience. but that's what I, you know, so we're at this liquor store, and so I'm like, I'll have bourbon. And they ordered they got, you know, 40s of beer. And so I drank myself into an alcoholic blackout that night. And I woke up the next morning, and I had leaves in my hair, and my throat really hurt, I think, from vomiting and that sort of thing. And it was a bad experience. But here's the thing that was so bad about it. I knew when I woke up that morning that there were chunks of time that were missing, but I somehow knew that I was awake and aware that whole time. I knew that I wasn't that girl who went and passed out somewhere. But I'd never heard anyone talk about a blackout. So I felt shame, I felt fear, and I certainly didn't want that to happen again. So I didn't drink anymore for a couple of years. And then when I was in high school, I met a boy. And he was handsome, dark hair, mustache. I don't have a type, do I? I was smitten. And I set out to get him, and sure enough, I got him to ask me out. And here's what a con man I am from way back. So he asks me out, and he's a year older than I am, and he hangs out with kids that are older than he is, and he's super cool, and I'm yay, and it's Friday night, and I'm all ready to go. And we lived out in the country, and we had a long driveway. So every car that would go by, we were sitting in the living room. I was sitting with my dad, and my siblings had gone out on their dates and such, and Mom was in the kitchen. And every car that would go by, I would, you know, and I'd sit down, and it was 6:45, and then it was 7, and then it was 7:15, and then it was 7:30, and I'd been stood up. And he called me, Richie called me the next morning, that was his name, Richie James, and he called me the next morning and he said, "I am so sorry." He said, "I was effed up last night." He said, "There's no way I could have come and knocked on your door and picked you up for a date." Because see, back then, somebody came to knocked on the door for a date. No, you didn't just get honk and go out to the date. And I said, "Richie," I said, "Daddy will never let me go out with you now. He's a prideful man, and he's not going to let his daughter go out with a boy who stood her up." I said, "But he's never met you, so we'll call you Randy." So for a year and a half, we called him Randy. Oh, yeah, worked out real well. We had one of those tumultuous high school romances, you know, very, very possessive and jealous and fussing and fighting all the time. And we were in one such fuss over a girl named Dana. There's always a Dana somewhere. And so we were in a fuss, and we went to, he picked me up for a date, and we went to a house party his friend Bruce was having. And I go into the kitchen with the women, and he's hanging out with the guys playing the quarter game. Is anybody familiar with the quarter game? It's kind of like beer pong, only with quarters. And they him being a little bit younger, they kind of picked on him, and he got really drunk, really drunk. And his friend asked, he said, you know, do you want me to drive y'all home? Because my curfew is getting close, you know? And I said, no, I said, I'll drive us to the house. Like I said, we lived out in the country, and that's almost a 30-minute drive. So we'll get him some coffee, we'll get him sobered up on the way home, and if worse comes to worse, he can go down the street. We had this little country road where we would go parking, you know? So I said, well, he can go down there and sleep it off. So I drive him, I drive us to my house, and he's really drunk, and I'm like, let me go get my daddy. And he's like, no, you know, daddy, because I knew daddy wouldn't let me go out with him. This happened. And so he said, I'll call you when I get home. And back then we didn't have cell phones or anything, you know, we had house phones. So I go in and you know, wash my face and go to bed, and at about 6 o'clock the next morning, there's knocking on my door. And his best friend, Kevin DeLeo, had come to tell me that he had hit a tree the night before and died. You know, that kind of grief when you're really young, it was too much. It was too much. I remember when Kevin was standing there, and I was, because it was so early, I wasn't dressed or anything, I was kind of down the hallway, and he was telling my mom and dad that, and I heard it, and I just went running past him and running out the door, just trying to run away from it, you know, and that was what I started doing, running away from it. And where the blackout had scared me before, because of the oblivion of it all, that was my solution now. I needed that oblivion of the bottle. And so I started drinking. You know, and at first, too, I have to say this. I'm so egoic. You know, I'm so egoic that I began playing the part of the poor grief-stricken girl. Do you know what I mean? Attention, it's so important. And I had that as one of my motives, and that allowed me to drink and to be, you know, irresponsible. And I began doing that. That happened on May 1st, 1982. And by December of 1982, I had met someone and married them, because I was a crazy girl. And I stayed married to him for about a year and a half. And finally, one day, he said, you know, he asked one too many times, baby, what is it? What's wrong? He would ask me all the time. I'd say nothing. And finally, I said, I just don't want to be married to you anymore. We were living in Joplin, Missouri. We had moved from place to place. And so I stayed there, and he went back home to Florida. And I got a little job at Bill Neely's Suburban Mobile Homes, and I rented a trailer from them. I'm officially trailer trash from Arkansas. I am. Yeah, and I loved it. It was my first time at being independent. Like I said, I have drugs as part of my story, but I'm just a real alcoholic, you'll see. But anyway, I had a friend who was going to come over and sell me some marijuana, and he brought his friend with him, and his friend's name was Todd, and Todd said, hey, do you have a mirror? And I said, well, yeah, look at me. Of course I have a mirror. He said, well, bring one in here and put it in. So I brought a mirror in and put it on the table, and he put out this white stuff and chop, 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 and I knew what it was, and I'd never done it. And so I did cocaine. And I thought, holy cow, why haven't I been doing this all along? I can be a wide awake drunk. It was brilliant. And this guy, Todd, seemed to have a whole lot of it. So I said, I want to move in with him. And I did, like in a week and a half. And I lived with Todd for about a year and a half in Joplin, Missouri. And of course, that spun out of control. And I made my way back to Arkansas, found a job at the Capitol Hotel, which is kind of like the Peabody in Memphis. It's elegant. It's a stately, beautiful old hotel and elegant. And the people that came in were just, you know, I mean, everything I wanted to be. And I started working in the bar. It's amazing. I would love to do a survey of alcoholics, because don't we wind up in the liquor industry at some point in our lives? So often, yeah. Because we're experts in the field, aren't we? I am. Which is probably why so many alcoholics end up in recovery business as well. But anyway, so I got this job, and it's beautiful and wonderful, and I meet this guy in a bar, because where else am I going to meet a guy in a bar? I walked up to him and tapped him on the shoulder, because I thought he was someone named Garland, was a friend of mine. So I come up and I'm like, hey, Gar, and he turns around and he says, I'll be Garland if you want me to be. I said, oh, you'll do just fine. So we started dating, and he was a hairdresser. He's the one who turned me red. I found out from my doctor that I had a medical condition and I needed to have a little procedure, and if I did so, I would have a window of time that I could successfully conceive if I wanted to have children. The time was finite. So I said, hey, Brad, let's get married and have a baby. And he said, okay. So we did. And he drank just like I did. And when I got pregnant, he didn't get pregnant. And even though I always say that, and there's always laughter, the bottom line is powerlessness means I don't get to choose when I drink. And pregnancy doesn't solve alcoholism. And I planned this pregnancy, and I drank in this pregnancy, and I did cocaine in this pregnancy, and I couldn't not do it. And I blamed it on him, because if he wouldn't bring it home, I wouldn't have to do it, you know? You know, and it's, I don't want to overstate it. It was not a daily thing, but there were times that I did those things and felt that shame and that guilt. And I gave birth to a healthy baby boy, smart as a whip. Oh my God, he's so smart. And it's amazing, listening to Chris's story last night, I say he's so smart. I gave birth to a boy who is a girl now. Her name is Vivian. She's 33 years old. So I share that story with Chris too. But I'm jumping ahead. So I give birth to this healthy baby, and that marriage breaks up, and I meet ex-husband number 3, and he is going to rescue me. He's going to be my savior. So he says, look, I'm going to go to Baltimore and work there. Come to Baltimore. Let me take care of you and Robbie, and that's what we'll do. And I said, okay. So he goes to Baltimore, and he begins his job and gets a place to stay. And I married someone else in the meantime. Hey, I called him to tell him, I'm like, Philip, I married someone else. And he said, you are so crazy. He said, get an annulment, come to Baltimore, and let me take care of you. I said, okay. So that's what I did. And it, because I was doing a lot of illicit drugs, and I was drinking a lot, but I just thought, you know, a lot of these illicit drugs. And so I go to Baltimore, and I didn't know anyone there except the man that I was going to marry, and so I didn't do drugs anymore. Now, see, I tell that to a real drug addict, and they're like, what do you mean they got drugs in Baltimore, don't they? You know? And it's because, like the line in our literature says, you know, if you're a heavy drinker, given a sufficient substitute, you can stop or moderate. You know, and a change of environment is one of those things that a heavy drinker can stop drinking if they have a change of environment, warning of a doctor. Well, I went to Baltimore. I didn't do any drugs because I'm a heavy drug user. But, oh, my Lord, my drinking took off with a vengeance. You know, I found the morning drink. We'd be on a vacation, and so there's the little Bloody Mary or the little, you know, pina colada with the umbrella. And the problem is I was a stay-at-home mom, which, man, I was, you know, I'd come home from vacation. Everybody else would go to work, and I just drank. So I became a stay-at-home drunk. When my smart kid who learned to read at 4 years old, he could read this at that time with punctuation and inflection, just so smart. I couldn't wait for him to start school. I wanted to be a room mom. My mother was. She was so beautiful and kind, and she would come to school, and she too dyed her hair red, oddly enough, and she would bring, you know, she would just bring her beauty and her sweetness, and I wanted to be that. And so when my son was in preschool, I went and volunteered, and I would read with the kids, and he outread them, and I was proud, and I was shaken in the morning. I would have to shake, and by the time he was in first grade, I couldn't volunteer anymore because it would either be shake so bad or try to drink vodka and try to cover up the smell to stop the shakes, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And that was what my life was like until he turned 11, so, you know, 6 years. There would be times when I would embarrass my husband at the time at a public, you know, at a dinner or something, and I would be that corporate wife on a drunk crying jag at the white cloth tables, or I would fall down in the house in front of my kid and bust my chin open. And I would say, I can't live this way anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I would shake and sweat and puke for 24, 48 hours. And then I'd start feeling better. And then it'd be like, the goose hung high. You know, this is the thing. I'm going to be a good, sober mom. And the darndest thing would happen. A week into it, my mind would say, Gina, you overreacted. You don't have to stop drinking altogether. That's ridiculous. You just need to not drink bourbon. You just need to drink wine. You know, because you're a lady, you can. Wine is practically a food product. It's got tannins in it. It's very good for your heart. Isn't that insane? And I would do it. And I would be right back in that place. Well, by the grace of God, in November, it was early November of 1999, I was on the second day of one of my we called it the cocktail flu in my house. It happened so often. So I was experiencing the cocktail flu for the second day in a row, and I got a call from my sister-in-law saying that my mother back in Arkansas had had a heart attack and I needed to fly home. And because I was 2 days away from a drink, I could actually pack a bag and fly home without flying apart. And I stayed for a couple of weeks. My mom is fine. I stayed for a couple of weeks and took care of the house and dad, and mama came home, and it felt good, and I didn't have a desire to drink, and it was great, and I get on the airplane to fly home to Baltimore, and I ordered a bourbon and Coke, because why wouldn't I? And then at Thanksgiving, that was really the beginning of the end for me. I went to pick up my son from his biological dad that he was visiting for the Thanksgiving vacation. And I got to the restaurant early so I could have a couple of drinks, because there's no drinking at mom and dad's house. So I got there early. And at this point in time, it's like my alcohol regulator in my body was broken. There would be times when I could drink and drink and drink and not get there. And then there'd be times when I'd have a drink or two and just be, you know, knocking tables over drunk. And this was one of those days. And I had a top shelf margarita with an extra shot of tequila, and that was it. And when my ex-husband and my son got there, I was turning tables over drunk. And I didn't literally turn a table over, but it was like that. And so we ate something, and Brad was, he was very kind. He didn't say, "There's no way I'm putting my kid in your car." But what he did say was, "I'm going to miss Robbie so much until Christmas. Is it okay if I spend a few more minutes with him, driving him to your mom and dad's? We'll follow you there." I said, "Sure." So we get almost to mom and dad's. There's a little church right down the street from where they had just moved a month before, right before her heart attack. And, you know, I'd been there for weeks with them. And Robbie gets in the car, and my dad drives, his dad drives away, and I start heading to mom and dad's, and I guess I'm really all over the road. I get lost, and my kid is panic stricken. You know, he's 11 years old, and he didn't have a cell phone back then. I had one, and it was like one of those big Nokia, you know, big flip phones. And he's crying, and he's got the phone, and he said, "Tell me how to call Papa. Tell me how to call Papa, Mama." I'm like, "Baby, we're not going to call Papa. I just got turned around. I know where I am now. It's okay. I'll go really slow," you know. And he is practically hysterical because of the life that he had lived with me, you know. And so I pull into this gas station, and he goes running out of the car, and I'm like, "Get in the car. I'll let you call him." So I dialed my dad's number and gave it to my kid, and he called my dad, and my dad was there like this. And when my father's car pulled up under the lights of the gas station, and I saw the look in his face, it was disgust. He just looked at me like, "Who are you, and what are you doing to my grandson, and what has become of you?" And I was ashamed. And we get to their house, and they didn't say anything to me. And the next day, we flew home to Baltimore, and I drank and 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 drank. Shame. My girlfriend came to get my son because I was in a complete blackout, and I came to on December 2nd, 1999. I thought it was December 1st, which is my mom's birthday. You know, and I was a bottle hider at the time, and I knew where, instantly, the moment I came to, I knew, A, where every bottle was in my house, and I knew, B, that they were all empty. I also knew that there's no way that I was going to be able to get to the liquor store. I was in too bad a shape, and I was going to be sick, and that was just what it was, and I was an awful daughter. I didn't get my mother anything for her birthday, and it's too late to send flowers, and I'm sick. And it was sometime in the early evening, I couldn't tell you when, but I hear the door chimes from downstairs. We lived in a townhouse, and I hear the door chimes, and I know it's my girlfriend who's keeping my kid with her and her son. My husband at the time is out of town on business. And she comes upstairs, and she comes in my bedroom door, and I'm buck naked under a sheet, having sweated through all the clothes that I could wear, and I smelled of vomit and cigarette smoke. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature, and I was unlovely. And she came in the door, and she looked at me, and I said, "I know I look bad." She said, "Mm-mm." And in behind her walked my father. Yeah, my husband had flown him in to do something with me. He didn't know what. And y'all, my father's face in that instant was filled with love and compassion for his terribly sick daughter. There wasn't any disgust. He just saw me, and he said, "Baby, what can I do?" I said, "Daddy, I don't know." But I did know. I'd visited Alcoholics Anonymous with my husband, previous husband, a couple of years before. I didn't see where it applied to me then. I felt bad for all you poor people. Hated that y'all couldn't drink anymore. Man, y'all needed to drink. Y'all had some stories. But I didn't see where it applied to me. But in that moment of grace, I knew I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew I would never have to drink again, and that's been the case for 22 years. Problem with being struck sober? the spiritual life is not a theory. We kind of have to live it, and I didn't want to do all this, these numbered things, you know? I mean, some of them were really cool. I mean, I'm all about the prayer, you know. I grew up within 5 blocks of both sets of my grandparents, and some of them were deacons and song leaders. But I got a sponsor, and she walked me through some of the steps, and I was not honest with her. I couldn't be honest. I could not be honest. She would say, "Now, have you read?" And yes, I sure have. I've read that book. Yes, ma'am, I sure have. Well, good. And so now we're in the third step, and you know, you've got the directions for, and I didn't know what any of it meant, what to do. But I did a fifth step with her. She gave me some worksheets to fill out, and I was contributing to my recovery, and that was a great, good thing. But if you find a sponsor that you can't be honest with, you've got the wrong sponsor. And there was a woman whose son was in AA, and she'd been sober a long time. Her name was Mary Love, Mary Love Boyce. I don't know what drew me to her, you know. I don't know. It was that thing. And I had a sponsor, but I'd go to lunch with Joanna and Mary Love, and I just kept using her as my sounding board and my confidant, and I wasn't using this other woman. That's just literally, I didn't ever reach a place where I said, "Mary Love, will you be my sponsor?" She just became my sponsor. And she never wagged her finger at me. She never said, "You shouldn't do these things." Because there were things long into sobriety that I was doing that was harming other people. What she would say were things like, "Well, I don't know if I could do that and be sober, but you go ahead and we'll see how that works." You know, and I'd bring the consequences to her, and she'd say, "Well, I was afraid that might happen, but you know, you'll learn from this." And because of my behavior, my husband wanted us to leave Baltimore and move to Memphis, where he's from. He was going to come here and take over his father's business, and I was a married woman, not behaving like a married woman. And so my thought was, sure, we'll move to Memphis and I'll give you back to your mama, and I'm going to go back to Baltimore and I'm going to be with my boyfriend, because that was my recovery life early on. So we get to Memphis in December of 2002, I flew back to Baltimore in May of 2003, and Mary Love had pneumonia. So I stayed with her for a little while and then flew back, and on April 1st, she called and talked to my husband and asked my husband to tell me that it was not, in fact, pneumonia, it was inoperable lung cancer, and she was going to die. And y'all, for the first time in my life, I prayed an unselfish prayer. I didn't say, which I would have always normally said, is, "God, don't take her from me." That was not even my prayer. It was, "God, let me be there for her." And I was. I was. I flew back and forth and took care of her, and she lost weight, and she lost her hair, and it would come out in my hands. I would wash her hair. I'm sorry. She was everything that I was not, you know. She was everything that I was not. And I'd say, Mary, love, you know, aren't you scared? Aren't you mad? And she said, no, honey. She said, because I've always had a fear of death, always. And she said, no, honey. She said, there's no special dispensation from death for me because I'm an alcoholic. She said, you're going to die too. She lost, like I said, a lot of weight. She was in a wheelchair on oxygen, had a chest tube, and yet she was still Mary Love. And she said one night that she wanted to go to the mall and pick up some brassieres because she'd lost so much weight. And I said, well, sure, let's do that. So we get in the wheelchair and the turban and the oxygen, and we go to the mall, and we're cutting up because she's my Mary Love, you know. Where I'm pushing her, and there was this pink loungewear outfit in the window. And at this time in my life, I was all about black boots, dark skinny jeans, black little jacket, dark red lips. Of course, the hair is really edgy, you know, too. So I had this idea of myself, edgy. And there was this pink... It was this pink loungewear outfit, and she said, oh, isn't that pretty? And I said, it is. Do you want to go in and take a look at that, Mary Love? And she said, oh, not for me, honey. I think that would be pretty for you. I said, Mary Love, I don't wear pastel. She said, no, honey, I know you don't. She said, but there's a softness in you that you don't even see yet. But others are seeing it, and that would suit you just fine. So I took her home, and I went and I bought it. And it was just fine. And I was holding her hand when she passed away. Her family was there, but they let me be there. And I did it. I took care of her. And I didn't think I could ever be trustworthy in that manner. And that is how God built me. By this time, we were living in Memphis full-time, and y'all, Memphis AA is special. It is special. I found this woman. Her name is Katie T., and, you know, God kept bringing me to her as a sponsor because I was, you know, Mary Love passed away, and I needed a sponsor, and I'm praying, God, show me who I need to have, and he kept putting Katie directly in front of me, and I'd be like, yeah, not her. Who I'm really supposed to have. She was younger than I was. She had less sober time than I did. She had relapsed at one point on some medications that led her back to the bottle, and she was 6'2". She had this brand new baby. Her name is Lily, and I met Lily when she was, and she was who I needed to sponsor me. She was much more mature than I in areas that I needed maturation, I promise you. I began working the steps in earnest, and I began becoming the woman that God meant me to be. And then I met this guy. And you know, my life was really messy, and what it looked like was I was still attached to an ex-husband monetarily, and I didn't think I had anything to offer. I was in my 50s. I had no resume because I had never worked. I'd been this corporate wife, this stay-at-home mom. I didn't have any education beyond high school, and there was this dark, brooding man who kept bringing his 14-year-old son with him to these AA meetings. And to me, that's just dead sexy, y'all. And you know, he expressed his interest in me. And I told him, I said, this is what my life looks like. And if you're okay with what this looks like, then yeah, I'd love to see you. And he saw something in me, just like Mary Love did, just like my dad did, that I didn't even know was there. And he gave me a chance. And he waited me out, because it took a long time. took a long time, and here's what that looked like. I wanted to marry him. And fear of financial insecurity had not left me because I had not made all my amends because I was still attached to an ex-husband that I wouldn't let go of because I was in financial fear. Funny how that just cyclically works, doesn't it? But I wanted to marry him. And I knew that he was getting to the point where he was losing patience, and it was time. And so I got this book called Drop the Rock. Y'all heard of that? If you don't want your life to change, God, don't read that book. So I started reading this little book, a little sliver of a book, and one of my home group members, Russ Kay, was talking about how he does nightly inventory, and he would write, you know, on page 84, it says, you know, where we've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. And then on page 86, it says, when we retire at night, what do we look for? Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Same four things. So he said what he does is he writes those four things on a sheet of paper and whatever comes to mind. I'm like, I can do that. Simple. So I started writing this nightly inventory, and my ex-husband's name was all over it. Every night. Every night. Every night. I resented the hell out of him for I resented him for putting me in a position that I couldn't leave because I was dependent on him. Dependent, and you know, it invites either domination or revulsion, our literature tells us. And I'm laying there in bed and I'm writing, and this is how I know that there's the voice of God, because it says things that this voice said to me. You need to take Philip his Rolexes back. I said, no, I don't. What? That's not my voice. My voice would never say such a thing in my head to me. So it had, and I'm like, oh, shoot. I had these two Rolexes. Now, I had my own, but these were the mid-size ones that the Kardashians made popular, and the mid-size, and my ex-husband had let me wear them with no intention of me keeping them forever, but I was intended to. I got up out of bed, and I put the Rolexes in their boxes and the links in it, and I texted my ex-husband, and I said, I need to come and see you tomorrow, and he said, sure. So I went to see him, and I took his watches back, and I thanked him for taking such good care of me, and I told him he wasn't going to have to do that anymore, and I was free. I was free, and y'all, honest to God, ridiculous miracles started happening. I opened my phone up. Me, who didn't think I had anything to bring to the working world, I opened my phone up to my spam mail, crazy enough, and in my junk mail, the very first email there was from the Shelby County Sheriff's Office. And it was a jobs listing for men and women who might have difficulties getting employment with records and that sort of thing. And the very first job there was for the Forest Hill Funeral Home in Bartlett, Tennessee. And I thought to myself, I love a good funeral. I do. I look good in a little black dress. I can move flowers around and direct family. I could do that. I put together this skinny little resume, and I took it up there, and they hired me on the spot. And I moved flowers around and greeted people for about 6 months, and then they moved me into an administration, and I was an assistant there for a year. So I had this job. I was becoming self-supporting through my own contributions for the first time in my sober life. And as such, I was able to be a true partner to another human being. And there's only one human being that I wanted to do that with. And we found this beautiful home in Cordova, Tennessee, that was in mid-construction, and it had a front porch, y'all, and everything I ever wanted, rockers and a swing, and we bought it together. And I was doing this thing. And then it was time to be married. I have a sponsee whose mother works for Robert Irwin Jewelers in Memphis, Tennessee, and I said, "Hey Taylor, I need to go see your mom. We're gonna get choose rings." And she's like, "Oh yay!" So we go, and Cindy was her mom's name, and I said, "Cindy, I want a uh, I want a cushion cut center stone, a carat and a half or more, flanked by 2 trillions set in white gold. She said, oh, okay. So I got to choose some diamonds that she brought in from New York, and I found the ones that I wanted and the setting that I wanted. And Bill picked it up on a Friday morning, and Friday night, he knew I knew he had it. And he knew it was time to propose. And he did so on bended knee in Huey's parking lot and did an amazing job. Saturday morning, Cindy calls me, the jeweler. And she said, hey, she said, I don't know if you and Bill knew this when you were getting your ring, but we were running a special. I said, do tell. She said, yeah, so if the Memphis Tigers in their opening game score a touchdown on the opening kickoff, all of the jewelry sold in, I think, a 2-week period would be refunded. And Tony Pollard ran it in for 99 yards, and we're giving you your $10,000 back. I mean, come on. That was my burning bush. God knew how to get my attention, but more than anything else, that was God saying, Gina, you were doing as I would have you do. And then just a few months later, you know, Brenda said that she sent out an email saying that she was going to New York. We had this beautiful wedding. So it was, I guess, a year later. So she said she was moving to New York. She sent out this email. Bill said, you know, Brenda's going to New York. And I said, he said, you should apply for the job. I said, they'll never hire me. I don't have any experience. And he said, you should always apply for the job as just a matter of doing it. I said, okay. And I was right, they didn't hire me. I got a rejection letter in the mail a weekend that I was out of town. Chairperson at that time had accepted the position and would have been a perfect fit, but then she had gotten a career advancement in her own company and was accepting it, and she called and asked, did I want the job? And I said, do I ever? And y'all, it is beyond my wildest dreams. See, when I moved to Memphis 19 years ago, the first thing I did was call the intergroup office to get a meeting schedule, just like people do, find out where the meetings are. And Brenda Brown was so good, in like the moment I came to Memphis, somehow I'm a volunteer in the office. And the fact that I'm there now, that I have become a worker among worker, a friend among friends, a vital member of my family, and a good wife sometimes, it's all because of y'all. Thank you so much.